WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Special Report. A development in the search for a suspect nearly 2 weeks after five people were shot and wounded on I-75 in southeastern Kentucky.
Two troopers and two civilians had found an unidentified body in the deep brush behind Exit 49 in Laurel County.
Kentucky State Police Commissioner Philip Burnett Jr.
We do have those articles associated with the body that we do feel is Joseph Couch.
The search for Joseph Couch had people sheltering in place and prompted school closures, but now
the people of Laurel County can rest easy, much easier, knowing that this manhunt has now come to a conclusion.
Laurel County Sheriff John Root says there are unanswered questions.
I don't think nobody on this stage wished that we would have found him in the condition that we found. I'd rather he'd been alive and he could have paid for what he's done.
CBS News Special Report. I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Civic Media News, I'm Derek Tritz. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Thursday is important for Wisconsin's hundreds of election clerks. It's the deadline to send absentee ballots to voters who have requested one. Plus, for municipalities that will be using ballot boxes, clerks can formally open them. Use of absentee ballots has surged since the start of the pandemic. You still have time to request one. After Thursday, once you request your absentee ballot, your clerk's office has 24 hours to mail it to you. Taylor Swift's endorsement of presidential candidate Kamala Harris may coincide with a 47.5% increase in Wisconsin voter registration. Taylor Swift endorsed Kamala Harris right after the presidential debate last week Tuesday. Since then, Wisconsin voter registration has seen an increase of more than 1,300, according to Vote.org. There is no evidence that Taylor Swift directly influenced this number. And that's what you need to know. I'm Derek Tritz, and this is Civic Media News.
It's time to go for the green or gold with Civic Media's new Text to Win contest. When you go for the green or gold, you could win $100 cash, gold jewelry, and be entered to win our grand prize, two indoor club-level seats to see the green and gold in Green Bay. Download the free Civic Media app in the Google Play or App Store and get ready to text in for your chance to win in this statewide contest. Get ready to go for the green or gold with your local Civic Media radio station.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for the Tom Allball Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Going to take a look back at our time at the Democratic National Convention. We, as I've been saying the last couple of days, we spent a lot of time talking with people, wanted to make sure that those interviews get to you, get aired, and we talk about the topics and the things that were discussed at the convention. I think it was an incredible convention, lots of positivity, lots of talk of labor, lots of talk of the future. And for me, you know, that's the good stuff. That's what we should be talking about. Which is why, you know, as I was preparing for today, I was checking some of my labor history notes, and it reminded me on this day in 1830, it was the day that the first locomotive ever built in the U.S., the Tom Thumb, raced a horse on a 9-mile course in Maryland, and it was one of these moments where, you know, technology was coming on board, and everyone understandably concerned about replacing horse and buggy with the iron horse, if you will. And I thought, as I was reading through the account by John Latrobe, who was one of the eyewitnesses of this historic race, I couldn't help but think the wording was great. So I wanted to read what, you know, part of his his account of this race was. He says, at first, the gray had the best of it, for his steam would be applied to the greatest advantage on the instant, while the engine had to wait until the rotation of the wheels set the blower to work. The horse was perhaps a quarter of a mile ahead when the safety valve of the engine lifted and the thin blue vapor issuing from it showed an excess of steam. The blower whistled, the steam blew off in vapor clouds, the pace increased, passengers shouted, the engine gained on the horse, and soon it lapped him. The race was neck and neck, then the engine passed the horse. But it was not repeated, for just at this time, the band which drove the pulley and blower slipped from the drum, the safety valve ceased to scream, and the engine began to wheeze and pant. The horse gained on the machine and passed it, and although the band was presently replaced, the steam again did its best. The horse was too far ahead to be overtaken and came in the winner of the race. And, you know, in that moment, it may have been the horse won the day, but ultimately, it was the Iron Horse that revolutionized transportation in this country. And we're kind of in one of those moments again. And this is where this idea of looking backward and pining for the past, because there are still people, my wife being one of them, that would prefer going back to horse travel. She loves riding horses. But it's not practical. And for all of the talk of technology that's coming, this head-in-the-sand kind of position that some of our elected leaders have taken is frightening, because it's going to happen with or with our permission, consent, and, well, regulation. And the farther that it gets away from us, the farther out of control that it gets, the more of this technology that's in the hands of privateers and profiteers whose only motive is to enrich themselves, the more difficult it's going to be for us to not be abused by it. And I think of the transition from the horses and the buggies to the rail. You know, just as you're organizing the Teamsters in Minneapolis and in other places to make those jobs of running the teams of horses, making that a better living kind of situation, in comes these iron horses that then put those people out of work and brought on another generation and another kind of worker, only to see those workers being exploited time and again. And we can go back through history of all of the rail exploits, being it from the people who the Chinese who laid the track to the African-Americans who worked on the trains. I think of the Georges, the 10,000 Georges of the Pullman Car Company, who all of the people who worked on the trains, their name had to be George. Didn't matter what their real name was. Their name was Hey George. I guess it's better than Hey Boy, but Hey George, and understand, it's kind of the same, but because George Pullman was the owner, and they had to be all the Georges. And you go back and you read these accounts, and I spend time doing this, of the transition and the difficulty of those transitions and how difficult it was for working people to adjust, not just frictionally from one job to another, but conditions. As they were making conditions better on one side, something drug it down, not only them, but the replacement. Also, poverty wage, despicable, dangerous jobs. We have the ability, as we're transitioning to this next economy, this next kind of industrial revolution, the technological revolution, we have the ability to make this a more just transition. That seems to be the word that's thrown out. But a transition where workers aren't the ones, again, taking it on the chin, as they had in every single change of society prior. We have the ability to make that transition more equitable, more profitable for working people, and less harmful for families and communities. We can do this. we are capable of ensuring that, yes, technology flourishes and we do get these new great things that are going to make our lives so much easier and better. Understand, I'm not a Luddite. I'm not saying we smash the machines. But at some point, you do have to talk about how are we going to control those machines? For me, that's the big part of this. But I want to hear your thoughts. On this day, are we concerned about the rise of technology? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. When we come back, we're going to have Tim Ryan, former Ohio congressman, on the program to talk about, what was going on at the DNC. John Nichols, political writer, and Tavis Smiley also going to be here on today's program. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1895. That was the day that Booker T. Washington delivered what came to be known as the Atlanta Compromise Speech, which outlined his vision for race relations and black labor in the South. Washington was the founder of the Tuskegee Normal and Industrial Institute, a college designed to train black students for careers in teaching, farming, and other trades. Washington was invited to give an address to the Cotton States and International Exposition in Atlanta. It was the first time that a black man was asked to speak before a black and white Southern audience. In his speech, he urged Southern landowners and business leaders to employ black labor over European immigrants. He said, quote, "To those of the white race who look to the incoming of those of foreign birth and strange tongue and habits for the prosperity of the South, were I permitted, I would repeat what I say to my own race. Cast down your bucket where you are." He continued, "Cast it down among those people who have, without strikes and labor wars, tilled your fields, cleared your forests, built your railroads and cities, and brought forth treasures from the bowels of the earth and helped make possible this magnificent representation of the progress of the South." His speech outlined a plan for gradual black economic advancement. He declared, quote, "Agitation of questions of social equality is the extremist folly." Other black leaders, most notably W.E. Du Bois, rejected Booker T. Washington's idea of gradual advancement. Instead, Du Bois fought racial discrimination through the legal system and helped to found the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Love conventions, because as I've been saying, we bump into people we've had on the show, folks we've seen for years. And John Nichols is that guy. He's the political writer over at The Nation, longtime friend of the show, going back, well, to the Wisconsin sleeping on the floor days back in 2011. John, thanks for taking time for us.
It's great to be with you. I remember when you were in the assembly hearing room of the state capitol, set up with your equipment during the Wisconsin uprising. I think that was where you were.
Yeah.
And it warmed my heart to see just how many interesting things were happening in the Capitol, including on those days, people broadcasting about labor rights.
Yeah, I like to say that I was one of the first programs to broadcast out of there.
Yeah,
because we were there right at the very beginning.
Yeah, I know you were, and it was a remarkable thing because it was profoundly peaceful. It was a community in many ways for a number of days, and you had government in play. They were having the hearings. It was an amazing time. But it was not a winning time.
No.
Let's be honest. And boy, have things changed.
No, that atmosphere, which at that point was electric with hope and anger.
Hope. Yeah.
I look at here in this convention, lots of hope, lots of for the future. I would argue, as you said before we sat down, the most pro-labor convention that I can remember.
I think it's the most pro-labor in history. The only competitive one might have been, when Lincoln was, because Lincoln was actually, very, very steeped in labor theory, and some of what he said in his speeches is amazing. But I digress, because that's not really the case. We didn't have the modern labor movement. If you think about conventions, and I wrote a book on the Democratic Party and have looked at all their conventions, I think this is the most pro-labor Democratic convention in history. I don't have any doubt of that. the only competitive one would have been in the 40s with, you know, when Sidney Hillman and the clothing workers were very, very influential right. with the Democratic Party. But I don't think the Democratic Party in those days put them up front in the way that they did. So I really think, you know, this is outreach. And boy, last night when President Biden mentioned how proud he was to have walked a picket line, they say he's the most pro-labor president, he accepts that description. And then the crowd went genuinely wild.
No, it was one of the longest, you know, applause that I've seen ever. One that Trump would brag about.
It's what
Trump's imagination would be.
Yes, you're right. I mean, because that was the interesting thing about it. You know, Trump and others have tried so hard to portray Joe Biden as somebody who, you know, just could barely function. And Joe Biden got up there and gave an extended, very effective, at times poetic
yep.
speech. But he also had real applause lines in it. Like, he reached people, and they responded. And that's not the only thing. I mean, look, we're at a convention, Rick, and you and I have been at a few of these things. We know our way around a little bit. We're at a convention that gave a featured spot to Sean Fain, arguably the most militant major labor leader at the moment. Sarah Nelson, very competitive there. But, you know, Fain got up there and just owned yeah. that stage. But then you also had very solid statements from leaders of SEIU and AFSCME and other unions coming up. So kind of an amazing moment. And then tonight, if my schedule is right, I hope I got it right, Bernie Sanders will get up. And I think you will hear from him, knowing, having been around some of his preparation on this, I think you're going to hear from him a very militant pro-labor message. So this is going to continue
what we need.
Night after night.
Clearly, this is what we need. And the hope is that this pushes Kamala and Tim Walz in the direction to continue what Joe Biden has started. As I've been saying on the show for the last couple of years, this administration has been transformational in moving us away from neoliberalism,
yeah.
reinvigorating the labor movement, yep. and using government the way it was supposed to be used under the NLRA, which was to encourage collective bargaining. That's their role. So to see that happening, and moving away from the DLC-type Democrats and pointing out how bad Republicans have been, this is an exciting moment.
Couldn't agree more. And I think what we're looking at now is, you know, kind of, I hope this won't offend too many of your listeners. I think we're sort of witnessing the end of the Clinton era. You know, Bill Clinton.
Not too soon.
Yeah. Bill Clinton Bill Clinton saw labor, I think, as an interest group, right? It was one of many, you know, you had to kind of keep a lot of these different
right.
interest groups happy, right? It's how you do politics. That's not how labor should be seen. Labor should be seen as the voice of organized unions, should be seen as the voice of the working class in America, which is the overwhelming majority of Americans. It should be seen as a counterbalance to corporate power, right? And you should respect it as such. And I think this is a Democratic Party that is starting to really do that in some fundamental ways. One thing you said a moment ago is that, you know, there's a hope that the tenor of this convention, the character of this convention, will cause, you know, Tim Walz and Kamala Harris to, you know, carry forward from where Biden's at. I don't think there's any question they will. I mean, I think that issue's actually settled.
I hope so. Words. There's talking.
And then there's doing.
And then there's walking. Yeah. And look, you know, Obama said he was going to walk a picket line.
And he had
comfortable shoes.
We're waiting.
Still waiting. Biden found those comfortable shoes.
Yep.
Went
yep.
for the walk.
Yep. So, and here's the interesting thing. Kamala Harris did the walks before Biden.
Right.
And so I think that her instincts are there. I've interviewed her a number of times. In fact, I've done detailed interviews with her about labor. And I can tell you that, she knows labor very well. And that's a starting point. Remember, there are literally people in politics who don't know the names of major unions, right? That'd be like not knowing the names of, you know, Apple and Microsoft. You know, it's like, how can you not?
Right.
Right. But there are. You know there are. We even see it in media. Folks will say, you know, they'll have the big story on a strike someplace, and they'll say the union. They won't even say the name of the union. So there's this disrespect. There's this disregard. There's this ignorance that we see in political and media class quite often. That's not Kamala Harris or Tim Walz. They know the unions. They know every union. They know them well. Kamala Harris was the co-chair of, or was actually the chair. She did it with Marty Walsh, but she was essentially the chair of the White House Outreach to Labor, essentially they had a thing to kind of think of new initiatives and stuff for labor. And that put her at almost every union convention, kind of almost every city she went to, she met with an apprenticeship program or leadership, something like that. So, Rick, my gut instinct, and I certainly hope I'm right about this, is that they're going to come in as a very, very, if they're elected, as a very pro-union administration. And so it's not about them. I think the challenge is the Congress. Can they build a campaign this time that is sufficient, that gets that sufficient level of union support, sufficient level of everything else, that they come through with a House and a Senate and with a much more kind of militant approach that is getting rid of the filibuster and, frankly, passing the PRO Act through the House, getting it through the Senate, and getting it signed. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
That's basics.
And if she were able to accomplish that, that puts her on Mount Rushmore, in my view.
Right. You and I can just go on a vacation then,
man. That puts her on Mount Rushmore because I do believe it, as I've been saying for years on this show, I think the labor movement is the glue that holds our societies together.
Yeah.
It's what unites us in workplaces. So those secondary interests fall by the side.
Yeah.
That fighting for better wages, hours, conditions, opportunities, standard of living, you know, health and retirement security, all of those things. That's the front. That's what holds us together.
Yeah, and labor's a great big thing. This is the thing to understand. Many people who didn't come up through the labor movement and haven't been around it a lot, they're like, oh, labor's divided. You know, or there are Republicans in some of these unions. Some of them will vote for Trump. That is true.
It's true.
That is true. Why? Because when you're in a sector where labor is still big and powerful, it's everybody, right? And so you're going to have liberals, conservatives. You're going to have Republicans and Democrats. You're going to have socialists. You're going to have libertarians. They're all going to be there.
Right, and the big part of that is the unions don't get to pick their members.
They don't, and wonderfully so. But they do have to represent them,
right.
And that's the key. But what I'm saying about that is that when we understand that, when we understand that labor is more than just a political party, it's more than just one sector of society, it is, when it's well organized, it's everything.
Right.
As it is, you know, I spent a lot of time in Iceland and in Germany, places like that. There, things are unionized that Americans can't even understand. Barbers, you know. And
we used to be there.
I know we were. And in fact, I think I got a barber's pin someplace. But what I'm saying about that is that's what we need to get back to, is that understanding of labor as it's the counterbalance to corporate power. It is the force that can go into a debate, can go into a fight and say, this is what's good for the working class, right? Labor can only do that when it's big enough and strong enough to counterbalance corporate power. And it's getting there. Things are moving in the right direction.
Absolutely. Yeah. And with some legal help, some comprehensive labor law reform to make organizing as easy as it was for my grandparents, we're back to where they were.
Yeah.
I mean, we have a prosperous working class again. But, you know, it sounds like you're making the argument that a lot of my Teamster friends seem to be very angry at me about, that I said I thought it was a dumb idea for Sean O'Brien to go to the RNC. Mm-hmm. Because that's the belly of the beast. Conventions are about promoting your candidate, getting them elected. So by being there, it's almost like a tacit endorsement. But I'm curious if you have some thoughts on
it. I do have thoughts on it. I was there for when Sean Fain spoke. It was a very interesting moment because it was...
Yeah, I'm talking about the RNC convention.
I'm sorry, I apologize. I would say Sean O'Brien spoke. I was there for both of them, at both conventions. You're asking, of course, about Sean O'Brien from the Teamsters when he spoke at the RNC. I was there for that. And what I can tell you is it was sort of a remarkable moment because he didn't, you know, he said a couple of complimentary things about Republicans.
No, he hammered. He did the show there. About 2/3 of his speech was doing the show. I'm in favor of that.
Yeah. So it was fascinating. There's a part of me that likes the fact that the Fox audience or whoever else, you know, whoever really tunes into an RNC, that they saw somebody up there talking about corporate power being out of control. And I kind of, you know, I see value in that. I don't mind that. And I remember in the past when both parties competed for union support, the only critique I really have of going there is that I don't think the Republicans are competing for union support.
No.
I think they want
those
votes.
The appearance, the illusion.
And that's very, very different. When I look at, like, 1956, right, when you had... Dwight Eisenhower and Adlai Stevenson competing for the union vote. And frankly, the Republicans did a better job because the Democrats were, the problem with Democrats in those days was they still had a big segregationist bloc within the party.
Right.
So they had these Southerners who were pro-right to work in the Democratic Party, right? So the Republicans actually had a bigger space in which to kind of deliver some messaging. In 56, they did fantastic. I will tell you honestly, when I look back as someone minimally a historian of these things, when I look back at you know, the 40s into the 50s, the Republicans were trying just as hard. And I'll tell you, even into the 60s and 70s, Richard Nixon took the unions very seriously.
And this is one of the arguments that I made. Someone convinced Sean O'Brien that he could be this generation's George Meany.
Yeah. And I'm not sure that's where we're at.
There's no way in a cold day.
Yeah.
And you, because the reason I brought this up is you had talked about leadership.
Yeah.
What I think Sean Fain did here at the DNC was clearly leadership. His membership is just as divided as the Teamsters membership is. But he was out there saying, like, this is where we need to go because this is what's in the best interest of our organization. That is leadership. Putting your finger into the wind going, well, we're going to decide which way we're going to go with this. I don't think that's leadership.
I understand what you're saying. And here's what I would say about the about what Sean Fain did here. Is every labor leader going forward going to be named Sean? I don't know. You know,
are they all going to be spelled differently?
Differently, and we have to learn these things. But no. But what Sean Fain did here was a very interesting thing. You'll get this, Rick. Not everybody will. And that is that he was speaking primarily to his own members. It happened that he had this national stage. It happened also that an awful lot of analysts were like, who is that? Wow, that guy's good. Like these people only cover politics and barely cover labor. We're like, wow, no wonder he did so well, right? It's because he's very good at presenting and he's very confident in this setting. But he was at heart speaking to his own members. And what's fascinating about Fain is that in that addressing his own members, he does not merely do a doctrinal, you know, list of what we want, right? He's a fighter. He's in there talking about Trump in fundamental and aggressive
Griddle.
Ways, calling him a scab.
Yep.
Right? There's probably a lot of people, sadly, that don't even know what the word scab means. They don't know its context, right? But suddenly they're looking it up.
Well, he's calling Trump a scab because Trump crossed a picket line.
Absolutely. And when people are on strike, you don't cross picket lines.
No, yeah. Look, I remember after my mother passed, I moved in with my grandparents.
Yeah.
And my grandfather didn't talk to me very much, but he said, if you ever go to that house over there and play with those kids, I will whip your you-know-what. I'm like,
okay, gonna miss on that.
So about 10 years later, I got older and I said, what was that all about? Turns out that guy crossed a railroad picket like 50 years ago.
Oh man, and that's the real story, baby.
And their generation, you did that was the death knell.
Oh no, I mean it's like I came up my experience somewhat different. Growing up around Kenosha, Wisconsin, which was an auto union town, very militant auto union, Local 72. But then as I kind of got a little older, I ended up over, you know, watching the British miners' strike in the 80s. And that was such a class struggle. And Arthur Scargill, who headed the miners' union, you know, literally his chant was, when people are on strike, you don't cross picket lines. And that is a, you know, that's like a just an ironclad basic concept. Well, you know, as a society, we've lost sight of some of those things, right? Now I think we're seeing a rebuilding of it. And it is an educational time. So much of what you're asking me in both these questions about, you know, Sean O'Brien and Sean Fain is, you know, how do we navigate this educational time? O'Brien, like it or not, thought, okay, I'm going to give this a try over on the Republicans, see what I can pull off here. I dare say that listening to Donald Trump's interview with Elon Musk, that Trump did not learn much.
No.
Fain, here at the Democratic Convention, is speaking, I think, to his own members and to potential members of industrial unions. And he's basically saying, you know, you hook up with us. We're going to go fight.
No.
And did you notice this? You're the only person at this convention probably that I can say this to, and you're going to get it. Do you notice how he mentioned it? I think it was the Cornell workers in the strike.
No, they're organizing them.
Yeah. So he mentions the people he's out working with.
Yeah.
And you're like, you know, I mean, you understand why he does that? Because he wants them to know that.
I see you.
Not only do I see you, I'm taking your story right into the hallways of power.
No, that it's brilliant. What he did was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
And as I say, look, every generation has to relearn what solidarity is. I think we're watching that in real time.
Yeah, I think we are. I don't hear the word enough. I'm not hearing that. That's a word I'd love to see writ large across this convention. I mean, that's the next step. I'm not too tough on people. I mean, I give people their space. I know that they're learning. They're coming to where they need to be. But at this convention, I do think that the U word, which is our entry drug, right? That's our first word. Union is being said.
Right. And
all
not
the
choked
time.
On.
Right, not choked on. So that's big. They've come there. If they could get through really comfortable saying union, then if they can start to say solidarity, right? That's, you know, that's next stage. And then at the end of the day, when the term collective bargaining can roll off your tongue, we might have gotten someplace.
There you go. John, great seeing you again. It's been too long. Got to get you back on.
I'm at your service.
All right. Our good friend John Nichols. Check out his work over at The Nation, where he is a political writer. Amazing stuff over there. Gonna take a quick break back here from the convention. Stick around.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show. This is the Shaw, WAUK. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Tonight, partly cloudy, a low in the low 60s. And mostly sunny for tomorrow, a high in the low 80s. Then a chance of showers and thunderstorms Thursday night into Friday, muggy, high temps into the low 80s. Around 80 this weekend.
Currently at 64 degrees.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
I noticed when you buy toilets, they all have like these snazzy names. The Ambassador. Toilets do not do any kind of ambassadorship. This is for people who take huge dumps, this model.
The Ultimax.
The Ultimax. Why would you name a toilet that? Just a serial number is fine.
Every single toilet should be called the King's Throne. That's it.
Works. It's a lot easier.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So thrilled to talk to my next guest, who we just grabbed walking through the hall here. And you may know him as a former congressman from Ohio, true working class hero, someone I would have loved to have seen become a U.S. senator, as opposed to, well, that other guy. That's why I've asked Tim Ryan to sit down with us. Tim, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing great. I'm loving life. How about you?
I got to tell you, I wish you were in the Senate.
Yeah. Well, you know, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? I figure if my contribution to the world is losing the J.D. Vance so that he could be an anchor around Donald Trump's neck, the Lord works in mysterious ways.
I love your positivity. So what do you think of the event here?
Amazing. You know, it hit me earlier. I was sitting there waiting. I was doing Fox News, and I was waiting because they were playing live Donald Trump's speech in North Carolina, and it was like greatest hits, the world's going to end, literally said World War III is going to happen, blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden in the background, because we were in the arena here, John Legend starts playing like Prince music, like, and the whole vibe like changed. And I thought, boy, that's really indicative of kind of where we're at in the campaign right now. You got the greatest hits, the old curmudgeon with the young curmudgeon talking about how the world's going to literally end if they don't win their election, versus hope, joy, and kind
of. No, I asked the cab driver, can you take me to that place, that burning hellscape that is Chicago? And he, I know the cab drivers know the area, but he couldn't find it.
Couldn't find it, yeah. I mean, you know, we've got challenges like every generation, like every country, and you know, we all don't agree even within our own political parties, but, you know, we should be grateful that we're Americans. We're in a strong country with a strong military and a strong economy that's not, unfortunately, hitting everybody. And we got work to do.
Got work to do. And for me, you know, being in this hall, the first thing you see is there's a lot of labor vibes here. Everyone's using the vibe word.
Yeah.
So I'm going to jump in on a lot of labor vibes. And as I've been saying, the way we reunite this country, the way we make this a better country, is we strengthen our labor movement.
No doubt about it. And I think, you know, as we build out the country, chips and this and that, I think it's important that we get the labor engaged, in that which they are, and down the supply chains for wind and solar. Like, we want those all to be union jobs.
Absolutely.
And that's how you're going to rebuild the middle class.
And here, the difference here is you look at what Biden-Harris had done. You look at what Harris and Walz are saying they're going to do. And you look at Project 2025.
Yeah.
Two very, very different visions for the country. One moves us forward. One takes us back to the Gilded Age.
Yeah, 100%. And that's the contrast. And I think that's it's generational change. It's hope versus fear. And it's who's going to be for you, who's going to be for rebuilding the middle class. And they got a long record. I mean, really, literally, even like putting out an economic plan, it's like we're going to double down on what we just did. Like, you know, more infrastructure, more building, more manufacturing. Like, we have the pathway. We have the game plan.
Sure. No, I mean, you come from a place that used to be. I mean, yeah. Say what it is.
Yeah.
Youngstown used to be a steel-producing place.
Yeah.
Used to be a manufacturing hub.
Yeah.
I grew up in Cleveland. Same
yeah.
thing.
Right.
Used to be where the jobs were.
Right.
Sadly, that was destroyed.
Yeah.
It's the rebuilding, making those places that are going to be.
Yeah. So now we have a battery plant. Now we have the big three reinvesting into, you know, going to electric. We've got data centers that need built by union labor. We got chips that we're making. So there's a path out of this, and it's not doom and gloom and negativity. It's here's the plan, you know, and let's work the plan.
No, it's a way forward. And this is what I'm hoping comes out of this convention. It's not just about being anti-Trump, because there are a lot of reasons to be anti-Trump.
Yeah.
But it's about being aspirational, that call to higher.
Yeah.
You know, I want to leave this country to my children, and I want them to have something that comes with it.
Yeah. And you want them to be excited that you could make a change.
Right.
And if things are bad, America, because we're a democracy, we're able to vote and shift public opinion and go in another direction. We're calling audible. Like, this sucks. This is not what we want. And that's what the American people were saying when it was Trump-Biden. They wanted new candidates. And
to Biden's credit,
thanks,
man.
Thanks to Joe Biden, we got a great candidate. And now they don't. And so the release valve is open. And the energy is pouring through.
Can he get much crazier?
Oh, God.
I mean, seriously. I mean, I'm watching more and more come out of him, and I know when people need to feel the need to talk,
yeah,
they start reaching, and it's desperate.
Yeah.
I know when I start to, when I'm looking for something to say, it seems rambling,
yeah,
because I'm grasping.
Yeah.
I think he's in that desperation kind of mode, because the old hits,
yeah,
they're not landing.
Yeah, and I feel like he opens his head up, and like this is the conversation going on inside his head. Like, he just happens to be standing there with a microphone and cameras. Like, this is what goes through his head all day. And you got to ask yourself, like, really, is this really the best we have to offer?
Yeah.
You know, is this the best that the Republicans have to offer? And the answer is no. I mean, there's a monopoly in that party, and we all know what monopolies do. You know, they squeeze out competition, and the prices go up.
No, without
question. Prices are going up with him.
But you brought up J.D. Vance and the albatross, now, as you said, around his neck. I know there are two couches in the Oval Office. there's a reason.
You just went right there.
There's a reason to keep them out of there.
That would make a lot of, like, state visits very uncomfortable, a lot of big high-level meetings.
No, but my problem is that this is a creepy dude.
Yeah. Oh, 100%.
I mean, and look, the message coming out of that is his attack on the women and, you know, women who don't have children. And my wife and I were talking about this, and we're like, you know, we don't have my mother-in-law can't take a year off work to come raise our children. You know, not, right. You know, we don't have the kind of safety net that his wealth has created for him. So this forcing people into having children, and it seems ridiculous.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's that's why, you know, they're weird dudes, man. Like, who do you know that you grew up with or played sports with growing up or grew up in the neighborhood that thinks that women should stay in a violent marriage or that there should be a national abortion ban with zero exceptions, or that the country really needs a Caesar to come in and, like, take over the country and fix everything? Like, that's some weird shit. And it's just a bizarre worldview that I think it's fine on a bar stool at a bar here in Chicago where guys are just BSing and talking shit. But the reality of it is this guy could be vice president to an old, unhealthy guy who could be president.
Yeah, it's scary times. Now, obviously, you've been to a bunch of these conventions. over the years. You're a veteran of this stuff. How's this different than 2008, or is it different?
It's different. I mean, Obama was clearly, a phenomenon too that came on, but he came on over time. This has been like a pop-up convention, let's get Kamala out. Great, everyone, boom,
because of Joe Biden, that's the case.
Yeah.
Everyone did coalesce around her because he came out and gave her a full-throated endorsement.
Yeah,
there was no ambiguity. There was no, hey, we don't know. He was very, very clear on who he was stepping aside for.
And I love the music. I love the fact that it's a really big production. And I love when the Republicans are getting mad about it, because that's when you know you're doing pretty good.
That's when you're hitting it.
I remember Hubert Humphrey used to say about Kennedy, I feel like I'm running against like a huge ad agency that, is selling soap or something, like in Mad Men 1960. And it was like, it's because you're mad because it's working. And I think they're mad because it's working.
So now in your neck of the woods, Youngstown, what's the vibe outside of here? Clearly the energy is here because the people here are excited. But when you get out into the towns, you're talking to people, you're doing all that. What kind of response do you think there you would get? And, how is this going to resonate outside of these walls?
Well, you have new people coming in. You have a super energized base of support, all those workers who work those years, whether things are good or bad. They're super energized. And what you get when you get new people coming in is you get their family and friends say to them, why are you into this? Why are you voting? And then the doors open then. Like, Joe or Rick's all of a sudden knocking on doors for Kamala Harris. Like, what's going on? And so they ask, and that just opens the door. And that's how you start building that circle out and getting new rings on that circle. And that's what you're seeing. And I think you're seeing a lot of Republicans around where I live that are just saying, I can't do Trump again. I don't know if they're going to vote for Kamala, but they can't. I don't know if Ohio will even be in play from a campaign standpoint. But
I got
to say
think,
that, it's pretty compelling.
I got to think, coming from a rural, I now live in a fairly rural area. Tim Walz plays. Oh. Come on.
Right out of Central Casting.
It's like you couldn't have created that character.
You know what, Tim? The only thing you need to be is a 24-year member of the National Guard. I am.
and a union guy, the guy who hunts and wears flannel.
Oh, yeah.
And
well,
all of that.
I love this new one about the IVF. And they're saying, well, his wife technically didn't get an IVF. It was a similar thing, da-da-da-da-da. I'm like, this is all you got on this guy?
He's
like a dude who doesn't quite know about all the fertility, nuances. Okay, good luck with that.
Are we going to now test conservative men on women's bodies?
Yeah. Oh, God.
Is that how that's going to work?
Yeah, is that what's going on here? Okay. It's so good, though. I mean, and he's just I served in the House with him. I saw him all the time in the House gym. He's just a good guy. He's just a good human being. And that's
so is he
want.
The guy that he plays on TV?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and then some.
Any insight? Any dirt?
Yeah, no. I mean, he looks terrible in shorts. I could tell you that. I saw him in the House gym. His
legs, now you just gave them.
Needs to do a little more work on his legs.
You just gave them a reason to attack him again. No,
He's
good. The reason I bring this up is because I think for a long time I've been saying Democrats are the party who, in a street fight, will offer to hold your coat.
Yeah.
I see this as a guy who's, who's willing to stand up and fight a little bit and do it with a smile and some snark.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's a good thing.
That's
I think that will
thing.
Attract white working class voters, especially my generation.
Well, that's how I think you have to make some of these progressive arguments is with no BS. Like, this is a matter of fact.
Yep.
This is not crazy. Unions are important. Government overreaching into a woman's body is too much. Okay. Yes, yes, yes. Okay, move on. Like, I think, and you obviously know this because you do it with your show, but, and I think about Big Ed Schultz, who used to be on MSNBC. When we moved him off of MSNBC, that was the beginning of us really losing a lot of those working class labor guys because he was very similar to that. And I think that's how you got to be tough. People know that you got to make tough decisions. You got to make hard decisions. You have to be tough on behalf of the nation, but you're also in tough political fights on behalf of people who need it.
Yeah.
And so to show that edge, I think, is good.
No, I remember when the and I know my audience is going to be tired of me saying this, but back when the whole when they go low thing came around,
yeah,
we do what? We got go yeah. high. You played football. What do you do when they go low?
Low man wins.
That's it.
Low man wins.
Low man wins. When they go for your knees, you smash their face into the ground.
You kick them in the clutch.
See, this is what I like about Tim Walz. I know Coach is going to bring that.
Coach is going to bring it. You know, I could see him throwing a garbage can across the locker room. Grabbing a guy by the face mask, getting them in order.
Well, there's a reference I haven't heard. Earl, Woody Hayes reference I haven't
punching heard. Punching the neck, yeah. Ohio guy, what do you think?
Me too.
Grew up in Cleveland. That's right.
So last line of questioning I've got for you. You know, obviously the energy here, the volunteers, a lot of young people.
Yeah.
You know, what's the marching order from you've run campaigns from today till the election day?
Yeah, register to vote. Get your friends register to vote. You know, a lot of people still aren't 18 yet, and they'll be 18 in September, October, early November. Get them registered to vote. And then I think we've got to really blow it out on the college campuses. I mean, it can't just be we're going to do TikToks and stuff like that, which is cool and very important and puts a lot of juice into the campaign. But it's got to be an organized effort to get kids out of colleges and universities and into the voting booth.
No, and we got to get out there, and you got to do what the labor movement does best. Get out there knocking on the doors.
100%. And I mean, I'm so jazzed about labor and the renaissance, almost the comeback of organized labor. I mean, I love, and Trump was complaining about the head of the UAW union today. If they're complaining about you, that's good, right?
That's
they're going into the South trying to organize auto workers. God bless, man. This is like exactly what the country needs.
I love Sean Fain.
Yeah, he's a great dude.
I wish my Teamsters union had a shirt like that. UAW, Trump is a scab. Sure, I wish I had. Wish I could get one.
Every union should have that.
Every union should have that. Tim Ryan, I appreciate the time.
Great to be with you, Rick.
Good stuff. Former Congressman Tim Ryan. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back here from the UC in Chicago.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back here to the UC, the United Center in Chicago. I'm sitting here with Tavis Smiley. It's not often you get to run into people that you admire, but Tavis Smiley, one of those guys I've loved on TV, on radio, all across media. The hero. How are you, man?
Man, if I complained, I'd be an ingrate. I'm delighted to be on your program, Rick Smith. And I, with a name like Tavis Smiley, I've been called everything but a child of God at times. Travis, Tavis. I wish I had a name like Rick Smith. You can't mess that up, Rick. You can't mess that up, man.
And look, I am someone who's terrible with names.
Yeah.
Absolutely terrible because it's so simple.
Yeah, it is. I love it, man. I love it.
So what do you think of this this little shindig?
It's been an amazing week. I've covered a number of these, of course, over the course of my career. The energy, the enthusiasm, the euphoria, hard to deny that. And yet, I'm not naive, and neither are you, Rick. This is going to tighten up. We're inside the bubble right now, and this bubble will burst later tonight. And tomorrow, we step back out into the real world. Reality sets in. I predict that Kamala, this ain't a bold prediction. I expect she'll get a bump out of this convention. I expect in the days ahead she may even move a little bit further ahead of Donald Trump in the polls. But it ain't over until the fat lady sings, as somebody once said. And between now and November, this race is going to tighten.
Yeah.
Who knows where we're going to be in November? My sense is, Rick, that she will crush him with the popular vote, but that don't mean nothing in a democracy. You need the Electoral College. And I still, in some ways, think this race may be his to lose. Now, my view is, at the moment, he's losing it every day.
Oh, yeah. The more he opens his mouth.
That's exactly right.
You know, because I keep going, you know, does he not listen to his advisors? At some point, do you you don't attack Congressional of Honor Medal of Honor winners.
Yeah. No, I think the answer to that question is pretty obvious to me, at least. He's never listened to his advisors. And when he does, he can only stay there for so long. He strays from the advice he was given. You look at his speech at the RNC in Milwaukee. He started out that night, you know, pretty good, talking about the assassination attempt, what it meant to him. There was a moment for him, that was a moment for him to connect with the humanity and all the rest of us. And what, 15, 20 minutes in, the guy goes off the rails. And he's 2 hours later, he's still talking, essentially. So he just can't husband himself. He can't contain himself. He just can't manage himself. Dude's got out of control proclivities. And so I don't think he listens to his advisors, but that notwithstanding, this race is going to get tight between now and November, so it ain't a foregone conclusion.
It shouldn't be, because you look at the realities. Never in my lifetime have we seen two candidates or two tickets that are so far apart.
Right.
The gulf between them is incredible, mm-hmm. especially since, you know, the Heritage Foundation has done us all the wonderful service of writing down all of the bad ideas that Trump will want to move on.
That's right, the Project 2025. It's scary. It's scary. I was talking to Ben Jealous, who's head of the Sierra Club, first African-American brother to be head of the notable Sierra Club, noted Sierra Club. And we were talking about the fact that there was a tape that leaked a couple of weeks ago. You may have seen this. A tape, Rick, that leaked a couple of weeks ago of a Republican operative who worked in the Trump administration, who said that part of their plan, part of their goal, connected to Project 2025, if Trump wins, is to erase, to wipe out any reference to climate change in any federal documentation. Yep. I mean, you can't put your head in the sand and act like climate change doesn't exist, even if you wipe it out in documentation. But just imagine that we would have an administration on the issue of climate, just that one issue, that wants to just wipe it out. You take out the old whiteout stuff. You want to white it out as if it doesn't exist.
Right.
But that's what we're up against. So if Trump wins and they have a chance to run their playbook, Project 2025, we are in trouble. And here's the thing that scares me about how much more dangerous this race is going to become, how much uglier and vitriolic it's going to get. Kamala Harris loses this race, Rick. She comes back home to California where I live. She'll make a bunch of money doing whatever she does, right? Donald Trump loses this. He's going to prison. So there's a level of desperation that he has.
Do you think he'll really go to prison?
Oh, I think that the powers that be would love to see nothing more. Now, I take your point, Rick. It would be unprecedented for him to spend even a night in prison. But I think that the die is cast on this. Somebody wants to be that somebody who sent him to prison.
I think he gets a house arrest at the most.
Yeah.
There's no way he's at Rikers.
Yeah. You may be right about that. But my point is that whether it's literally behind prison bars or not, right. He loses this. He's going to serve some time somewhere.
And that's the hope.
And that's exactly.
Because, look, the reality is, do we want to repeal the 20th century?
Exactly.
This is the central question of this election.
That's right.
Do we believe in democracy? Do we want to repeal the 20th
right.
century?
Yep.
Now, look, I have a lot of red hat friends who are okay with the idea of returning to the good old days of the Gilded Age when women were back in the kitchen, gays were back in the closet, and minorities were back in the fields. Mm-hmm. That's a dream world, and Project 2025 kind of, as I'm reading it, lays it out. So do you think that people are waking up to that? Do they realize that? Or is this just more politicking?
I don't think they've awakened to it as yet. Again, you do this every day, and you do it quite well, and I attempt to do this every day myself. But the majority of the country isn't yet checked in the way that we are. But as you also know, every 4 years we have this sprint from Labor Day till Election Day. And in that 8-week period, people do tap in. They do tune in. And of course, we got this first debate coming up on September the 10th. So I don't think that everyday people are tapped in now as we are, Rick. But that day is fast coming when people will be tapped in, and we will see if the Democrats can be on message in getting people to understand what would in fact happen if Project 25 can be advanced under a new Trump administration.
Yeah, what does this convention mean to the minority community? I mean, you had Barack Obama
sure.
here. I had Michelle Obama here giving big speeches. But you got Kamala Harris, historically, the first woman to run for president, the first black woman to run for president. This is, to steal a Bidenism, kind of a big freaking deal.
Yeah, other black women have run for president, but she's the first to get this far. Obviously, it was Shirley Chisholm, of course, if you recall.
Right.
So Shirley Chisholm ran, and even Carol Moseley Braun, former senator from Illinois, ran. Others have run, but nobody, to your point, Rick, I take it, had the success that Kamala had and it will have tonight when she gives her official speech accepting this nomination. But it means a great deal. I love your question. It means a great deal to our community because black people have been so disenfranchised politically, economically, socially, and culturally for so long. These victories don't come easy for us. My friend Jesse Jackson, who I saw earlier this week, who was here in the hall on Monday night, Jesse said many years ago, Rick, that Jackie Roosevelt Robinson wasn't the first black guy who could play Major League Baseball with the white guys. He was the first one who had the opportunity to play Major League Baseball with the white guys, and he acquitted himself quite nicely. So that for so many in my community who've been talented and gifted beyond measure over many centuries, but never had the opportunity to step forward in the way that Kamala has. Kamala stands tonight on the shoulders of a lot of great people, black men and black women, many of whose names we'll never know, but who sacrificed and served and loved and bled and died for me to be on TV and radio every day, for her to be the Democratic nominee for president. So she stands on shoulders tonight, and I am certain she's going to acknowledge those shoulders she stands on tonight. It's a historic moment. Barack Obama, of course, the first, but she's a little bit different. The other thing is, Rick, that she connects to the black community in a different way than Barack Obama. Obama had all of us line up behind him, no question about it. After, I remind my black friends, the good white folk in Iowa gave us permission to do so. He wins Iowa first. Black people at that time were still supporting Hillary Clinton 2 or 3 to 1. When he wins Iowa, then we look at this brother. We all line up behind him. And the story, as they say, the rest of the story is history. But Kamala Harris connects Rick in a different way. She has been a member of a black church, a Baptist church, for many years. She's got the church tradition. She went to an HBCU, a black college, as you know, Howard University. She has that connection. And she's a member of a black sorority, a.k.a. we call it the Divine Nine. There are nine noted black fraternities and sororities. I'm a member of one of those fraternities, Kappa Alpha Psi. So she's part of the Divine Nine, as we call it. So she connects in that triangle, the black church, black college, and a.k.a. sorority. She connects in a way that Barack Obama never could and never did. So beyond her just being the first African-American woman, there are all these other connections that so many people in the community across the country feel in relationship to her around. So it's a big, no question about it, a big night for black America. And yet I close on this note. I remind my friends all the time, Rick, in black America, that we cannot be seduced. We can be supportive, but we cannot be seduced by the notion of black faces in high places. We still have to hold Kamala Harris accountable. She's black, but not unlike Barack. If she wins, she will still be the head of the American empire. And that alone means that you have to have a critique.
There you go. Tavis Smiley, great seeing you. I appreciate you taking time
for us. My pleasure,
Rick
Smith. Appreciate you, man.
Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Thanks for tuning in to The Rick Smith Show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Rick Smith Show, like us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can find all that and much more at TheRickSmithShow.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I want to finish up today's program with an email from Janice, who thanked me for talking about my experience as a kid in the school lunch line. And she shared a very long, way too long to go through here, email about her experience and, again, the separate line, the separate kind of food that was served during lunch during her school years, and that feeling of being, well, less than. And to me, this is why I think what Tim Walz did in Minnesota is so important. Everyone gets school lunch. Everyone should get breakfast in the morning. We should make sure that kids are fed. It's the least that we can do. But I wanted to thank. I wanted to point that out because on Monday we talked to a cafeteria worker. And the president of his local about the lunch programs that they had and how, the workers there were, essential and all that, and how now we're just kind of doing away with it. So to have that story, thank you. I appreciate it. It makes me feel like that I wasn't alone. But if you've got thoughts, I want to hear it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast, wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com.
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.